Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. Chatter on Books is about to begin. A reminder to put your cell phones on stun and say hi to your neighbor.
Sorry. Thanks, Jamie. That was Jamie McIntyre. That was awesome. On demand. I'm Tori Clark. Welcome to Chatter on Books. We are very, very, very happy to be at Loyalty Books in Silver Spring at 823 Ellsworth Avenue. Michael Kornheiser is here. Claude is here doing all the really, really important work. Jamie McIntyre is here with the greatest voice in radio.
Yeah, no, I think I was supposed to do that. I was supposed to say, okay, go ahead. You're listening to Chatter on Books, almost live from beautiful downtown Silver Spring. And Loyalty Books on 823 Ellsworth Avenue.
Much better. Thank you.
That's the best I could do.
So we have got a great show tonight. I've got one random thought. Jamie's got some Jack Reacher chatter. Michael, Professor Kornheiser, is going to kick off our virtual book club on Station 11, which really becomes more and more current.
Terrifying.
Terrifying. Current all the time. We're going to spend a little time chatting with Hannah Oliver Depp, who runs this wonderful place, who's on her way here as we speak from the Kennedy Center. And our featured author is Andrea Chambly, who is an amazing, amazing person. I've kind of gotten to know her a few phone calls and through our dear friend David Aldridge. And she finished the book, The Capital of Basketball, which was started and almost finished, right, Andrea? Almost finished by her husband, John McNamara, who very sadly, very tragically, was one of five journalists killed at the Capital Gazette in June of 2018. It is a history of D.C. area high school hoops. It's an incredible book. So we're going to talk to her about her. We're going to talk to her about John. We're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about the work that is keeping her so busy these days. And on Deserted Island, instead of our usual routine, I want to do a little mini debate, because today would have been Steve Jobs' 65th birthday, which makes me feel old. I think of Steve Jobs as a very young person. He would have been 65. So I want to talk a little bit about whether or not all things Apple have been good or bad for books.
65 seems really, really old, by the way.
Really, yeah. It's 45. It's the new 45. But first, Calvert Woodley, our sponsor, which is down the road in D.C., the greatest wine liquor store around, 4339 Connecticut Avenue, the greatest, most knowledgeable staff. And we have a wine of the evening, which lots of people here at Loyalty Bookstore, and their little heads nodding and little cheeks are getting a little flushed. This is called La Vendimia. It's from Palacio Raimondo. La Vendimia, I learned, means the harvest. And this is a blend of Spain's two original star varieties, Tempranillo and Garnacha. Jamie, notes of ripe red and yellow cherries?
I forgot to read my winology book to speak in wine language, but it's delightful.
Yeah, it's Spanish. It's really
very nice.
Good.
I'm going to just take a little bit right here.
It's
you can't see
this.
It's
supposed to have a
long
finish, whatever the heck that means. Yeah.
Tori, your pronunciation
goes down very well.
You never took high school Spanish, did you?
No, I never did.
I don't know what they taught you.
Vino
up in Pittsburgh.
Vino y cerveza. That's all I can do. Okay, you can do the wine
Denada.
Next time. Denada. And Ibrahim, who I saw today at La Cheeserie wearing a very jaunty little beret, it was really very cute. He gave us our 6 months age Spanish cheese from Idiazabal. How would I pronounce that, Michael?
A plus.
Thank you. From sheep, generally in the Basque and Navarre region. It's pretty good. And if the folks here at Loyalty Bookstore want some, it's back there by Gene at the cash register.
You know, you really can't go wrong. You just go in, you say, I'd like the wine, and then I'd like the cheese to go with it.
Yep.
And you're all set. You don't have to think about it.
I don't know how they get paid at Calvert Woodley, but the cheese guys seem to know as much about the wine as the wine guys do. I always start with the wine, obviously. I go in there, and Bill and Steven took care of us today, and they did a lovely job with this Spanish Rioja. But you walk over to La Cheeserie and just hold it up, and they go, oh, that's, then they start talking about it, and they give me more information about the wine than the wine guys do sometimes. And then Ibrahim or his staff give us these great cheese, so we love them.
Sometimes I like to mix it up and just go for the cheese first. Sometimes I just buy the cheese.
Can they do it?
Yes,
can the wine guys do it? Okay, I just have one quick one, and then we're going to talk to Jamie about Jack Reacher. So Ron Charles, he's been on the show. I think he's been on the show twice. He is the book critic for the Washington Post. He is a remarkable guy, and he's kind of the essence of what I think this show is a lot about, which is books kind of run through everything else. He is so knowledgeable. He is so funny, and he has a newsletter. And if you don't get his newsletter, you should subscribe to his newsletter, which comes out on Fridays. And I love it when it shows up in my inbox.
I subscribed, and for some reason, I'm no longer getting the newsletter.
I'm on it.
This is not the place to start making complaints.
Well, I just thought I could lodge you with the Washington Post officially.
Good to, yeah, it's always good to complain about the Washington Post. Always good. This is the show that Ron Charles should be doing, but the Washington Post doesn't have enough imagination to do a show like this. That's why. But he does this newsletter. Comes out on Friday. It's great to read. And he did a thing the other day, big in the news, Trump pardoning a lot of different people. And Ron Charles figures out very quickly that a bunch of them have written books or been the subjects of many books. So Rod Blagojevich, the governor, his book was called The Governor. That's really original, in which Blagojevich proclaims himself Icarus. But Ron says this week he's more like a phoenix rising from America's ashes. Bernie Kerik, the former New York police commissioner, had a book, From Jailer to Jailed, a little bit more honest on that one. Michael Milken, the junk bond, didn't write a book himself, but several books were written about him. And then Angela Stanton, I had never heard of this woman because I don't follow the housewives of various places, those shows. Mm-hmm. But she was one of those housewives. And she wrote a book, a memoir called Lies of a Real Housewife. But he's very funny. He's very smart and he's very current. So that's it for me.
Is the newsletter free?
Of course.
That's my favorite.
Of course. That's why favorite the
price to pay.
That's why the Washington Post isn't doing well. Yes. That's why. So I kind of know who Jack Reacher is. Jamie knows a lot about Jack Reacher. Michael's nodding his head going, maybe.
No, I'm just tired.
Okay.
So Jack Reacher is a character created by Lee Childs. That's his pen name. And the books are amazingly popular. He's been writing them for over 20 years. To anyone who's ever wanted to sort of write an action fiction adventure kind of centered around a mysterious stranger hero that comes in and does right no matter what the consequences, this is that kind of book. But they're not as easy to write as you would think. Lee Child, who has a really sort of interesting backstory. So first of all, the books are all set in America, and Jack Reacher is a former U.S. military police officer, the character, and he's literally a larger-than-life figure because in the book he's 6'5" and weighs about 240 or 250 pounds.
Normal.
And he knows how to fight, and he knows everything about armaments and guns, and he's always on the side of right. And the books are enormously popular. Lee Child was laid off from his job at Granada Television when he was 40 and decided he'd write a book. And he wrote the first Jack Reacher novel in longhand on a pad, and it took off. Since then, he's written, 20-something books, 25 books or so, and he's and the books are very, very popular, and they were made into a movie starring Tom Cruise, much to the dismay of Jack Reacher fans, because Tom Cruise looks nothing like the character Jack Reacher. Anyway, the big news in the Jack Reacher Lee Child universe is that he announced last month that he's going to retire from writing the books at the ripe old age of 65, because as I mentioned earlier,
$10 billion is enough.
Well, he actually is said to be worth 40 million British pounds. So you'd have to do the conversion in
more.
Your head.
That's all I know.
He sold over 200 million books in 78 Jeez. Countries. And he just started writing them. And so the books are really, the reason that they're so popular is his writing style is really compelling. If you pick up any Jack Reacher novel and you just open up and you read the first line of the first, the opening line of the book, it immediately takes you into the story.
Which is hard to do.
And of course, the whole trick about writing fiction and writing a page turner is that you want the reader to want to know what happens next. You know, if I say something like, I was in the room and suddenly there was a really loud noise, the next thing you want to know is, well, what's the noise? I mean, you just need, it's a simple narrative technique, but it's not that easy to do.
Because you've tried.
I mentioned it because just recently I picked up some Jeffrey Archer books.
Oh, yeah.
He's a very popular author. But I'm reading the book, and he's giving me a lot of the backstory of the character. I mean, a lot of the backstory. I mean, if you could go to Wikipedia, there would be.
Yeah.
I keep thinking, well, when do we get to the story?
Okay, but back to Jack Reacher.
Yeah,
if you read the Jack Reacher books, are you, and you're a serious Jack Reacher reader, are you offended by the movies and Tom Cruise?
Oh, yeah. So yeah. There was a big backlash to the. Lee Child, whose real name is Jim Grant, or I guess because he was born in England, I guess it's Jim Grant. Jim Grant. Anyway,
but why do you change it from Jim Grant or Jim Grant to Lee Child? It's not like his name was Jim McGillivary and decided I needed something cleaner.
I don't
know. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm interrupting.
So he wrote the book. He believes that, you know, he wrote the books, and then he believed that the books were the thing. And, you know, if you could probably count on one hand and have a couple of fingers left over the number of movie adaptations of a book that were better than the book. Most of them are not better than the book. And he sort of considered the book to be the thing he was writing, not the movie. So, and he wasn't really in charge of the movie. And so, you know, the way Hollywood works is in order to get a movie funded, you have to have a big name star.
Yeah.
Can't have a nobody.
Oh, and Tom Cruise wanted to play a role like that, of course.
And Tom Cruise had all the sort of attributes, except for the fact that he's 5'7" and I think weighs 180 pounds, and Jack Reacher's supposed to be this really big, massive guy. So Lee Child was okay with it, plus he didn't really have much to say about it. But the fans really revolted. They just said, you know, he doesn't have the physicality to play this character. So just to flash forward, as Lee Child is stepping down, he's going to let his younger brother write the series from now on, who's also Andrew Grant. Although he has to now take the surname Child in order to take over the franchise.
So it'll be Andrew Child?
Yeah, it'll be Andrew Child. Okay. The first couple of books, the next books will be written Lee Child with Andrew Child. And they're going to keep the series going. And, you know, this is not unprecedented because other authors who have wanted to step away from a character.
Hunt for a Red October guy.
Tom Clancy.
Tom Clancy did Hunt for Red October, huge success, good movie. And then a couple others, and then he started partnering with other authors, and it never worked out as well. Dick Francis, who wrote great books about horse racing.
His son.
It did not work out well. It generally doesn't work out well.
Well, Robert Ludlum in the Jason Bourne franchise, and even there was authors who wrote subsequent James Bond books after Ian Fleming.
So here's the critical question. Will you read these books done by his younger brother?
So his brother has watched him write these books from a long time. So he's 65. His brother is 51. And he's going to, you know, he says he was the first Jack Reacher fan, and he's going to try to do the same sort of thing. So we'll see how successful it is. But the big news for Jack Reacher fans is that Lee Child is becoming the executive producer of a new television series based on Jack Reacher. And unlike the movie, it's going to be one of these, you know, 10, 12 episode bingeable in one weekend things.
I love those.
It's going to be on Amazon.
Yeah, of course.
And it's based on his first novel. And what they're hoping, well, first of all, they're definitely going to get somebody who resembles the character in the book. And what Lee Child was saying is that he would really like an unknown to play the part.
Good for him.
So that you're not associating it with the person. And so so fans can look forward to that. And the series will go on. And the one other thing I just wanted to mention was one of the reasons I really liked this series, aside from the sort of sparse, really sort of engaging writing, and the one thing you lose in any adaptation is you lose the writing, the feeling of the writing, is that it was really, to me, really evocative of John D. McDonald's famous series of Travis McGee, who was similar to Jack Reacher, was sort of a knight errant, correcting wrongs. Mm-hmm. And it was set in Florida at the time when I went to school, University of Florida. And the writing, John D. McDonald's writing was really terrific. He also wrote Cape Fear.
Oh, great.
And the way his series ended, he wrote 21 Travis McGee books, which are still considered classics, is he died. He wrote the 21st book, and then he was taking the character in another direction, and then he died. Now, Lee Child said he had thought about having Jack Reacher die in like a big hail of bullets, like at the end of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or maybe just doing what he does in a lot of the books.
And then his brother said, please don't do that.
He gets
I need a job.
Bus and rides off to nowhere. But he felt like that would be letting down
we'll see.
His fans.
Okay,
so anyway, it's an interesting time. And so we're all looking forward to watching the new Amazon series and seeing if his younger brother can pick up the mantle.
And you'll have to come back and talk about it. The greatest line I ever heard about good books being turned into movies or TV shows were Chris Buckley, who wrote many funny, funny books. His first one was called Steaming to Bambulo, which was very funny, but it didn't sell two copies. But then he wrote Thank You for Smoking, which was this great satirical thing. Heads or not, I love that. About what was it? It was a smoking and alcohol and gun lobbyists, right? All hanging out together. Hilarious, bestseller, so funny, and of course it gets sold immediately. I don't know who's going to turn into a movie. And he gets a phone call from somebody who introduces himself as the guy who's going to write the screenplay and says, "I'm the guy who's going to bleep up your great book," because that's what happens. Okay, thank you, Jamie. That was lovely. Michael, Jack Reacher ever?
No,
not a one.
No.
Will you ever?
I have a copy I can lend you.
I'm good right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
So
no, I've got a long reading list.
Talk to us about Station 11. For people who are here at Loyalty Books, where we very happily are in Silver Spring right now, Michael is the teacher of the group. He's the professor of the group. And for some time, he's talked about, when are we going to read a book together? And when are we going to kind of have our own book club kind of thing? And I said, okay, you're up, big guy.
What's so great is we're coming full circle. We did the show to get away from book clubs and book club culture, and now I'm bringing us right back to it. Before I get to Station 11, yeah. I just want to say, here at Loyalty Books, I can't keep my eyes in one place just because there's an even better bookshelf in every single corner. And you guys have what I would call writing desk secretaries that are Post-it worthy, which is if I were going through someone's house, I'd be tagging it with a Post-it note, imagining where I would bring this back down to our house. No, so I wanted to this book I think came out in 2014. I had not read it since then. And when I was thinking about this segment for us, I wanted something that was accessible, that felt timely, that felt still current, though it wasn't what I would call an airport front level top of the store book. So it didn't just feel like you were picking up the latest top 20 sort of highbrow lit piece. And I wanted something of a certain length. It didn't feel like it was going to take you a month to get through. What I did not realize was how the coronavirus would continue to accelerate. And after the news that we've been seeing over the weekend, having just finished this book, that sort of in 2014 is looking at this post-SARS, post-swine flu world as to what would happen if. And now we're beginning to see the continuation of that if. So I want everyone to be able to read this on your own terms. I don't want to give you reading assignments, but I thought I'd give you some of the activities that we might start with. And so for me, I'd be totally open with a book club, with a group, with my kids saying, we have a post-apocalyptic novel right here. And we're going to see a world that begins to shrink and a landscape that looks unlike anything you've ever seen. And in terms of timing, it starts in the now, but it branches out from the now and it goes back into the past. We're trying to figure out what happened personally and what happened sort of culturally that led us here. And then we're also going to start looking into the future. What are the next steps? And I think a really easy activity that would be simple but still worthwhile just to get the questions going would be, what would you bring with you? If I said, hey, we're going to march down George Avenue.
That's
and
awesome.
We're moving north. We're going to move out east. You can choose your own safe location. We're going to quarantine ourselves. What would you bring with you? And if you have kids, if you're with students, it might be just the quick grab personal possessions. And obviously you get the rabbit hole questions. Well, what happens when your iPhone runs out of juice or we no longer have cell tower service? What do you do? No data. Well, I got my games downloaded. All right. Well, what happens when I've got two young kids and I'm trying to figure out, well, what books would I bring? How do I choose, say, the going to bed book versus Daniel Tiger goes out to dinner? Well, does he really need to know how to order off the menu?
But this is one of the reasons this is great, Michael, is giving us homework, but light homework.
Yeah.
But what would you bring? Because this could be very practical advice sometime soon.
And I think if, let's say you had your neighborhood book club.
It'd be fun and practical.
This could be a great, hey, we're all going to meet together for appetizers, have a glass of wine, and we're going to try and read out if we're trying to build the norms. How does this feel like a comfortable place that it doesn't matter if you have your PhD in English literature? You can say, well, I would actually bring this family photo because it means a lot because it's from my grandparents when they first came over to this. And that's something I want to recreate going forward. So I would start with that. And we often, as we get into these books, we see a little epigraph before the book begins. And we're not really sure what to make of it. And a lot of times it's great to circle back after we've read that. And I have the luxury of having read this book now more than once. But I wanted to start with a simple activity. So we might call this a fancier term if we were in class, but I would just call it a talking notebook. So I would ask our participants at home, take out a piece of loose leaf paper and draw a simple four square pattern. Just a simple cross through the middle.
What's
you're going to have four boxes.
Okay,
doesn't
boxes.
Matter if
Got
you have six, doesn't matter if you have eight. We're just going to have the chance for you to continue to write into a document. And I'm going to read this epigraph to you. And as I read it, I would love for you to isolate a word, a phrase, an image, a piece of punctuation. And I want you to write into it. By that, question it. analyze it if you feel comfortable analyzing something. Make a prediction. And from that, I think we're going to have good good dialogue. So I'll
Jamie
start here.
Jamie needs a bigger box.
I wrote a box, but I'm going to need a bigger box. I can tell from where we're going.
The bright side of the planet moves toward darkness, and the cities are falling asleep, each in its hour. And for me, now as then, it is too much. There is too much world. Now, if I were leading our discussion, I would say, I want you to take 5 minutes and write into the document. What are you first noticing? I'll give you a couple opportunities, but I want to leave that a little bit open. For me, it's cities are falling asleep. How does a city fall asleep? Is it the people? Is it the sort of ideas? Is it the sort of the cultural practices? Is it what the city represents? What does it mean for an entire city to fall asleep? Is it good? When I think of falling asleep, I think of, wow, I've had a long day. I think of putting my son to bed. He had a good full day. He falls asleep. There is something peaceful of falling asleep. Well, is it always peaceful? What if you don't want to fall asleep? What if you don't wake up? Each in its own hour. Wow, this is sort of embedded in its own little section. It's bracketed off by commas. Why are we forcing this into its own box? Each in its own hour. Is it supposed to fall asleep? And I would write that in my first box. 5 minutes are up. I want you to keep writing for that full extent of 5 minutes, even if you're going in a couple different directions. At the end of 5 minutes, pass your box 2 to the right, 3 to the right, whatever number you want to come up with. And you are going to write into original poster's box. Wow, I saw you focusing on cities fall asleep. I thought of too much world. It is too much. Hard stop, period. Maybe this burden, maybe there's something weighing down on this person, this planet, this city that's forcing them to fall asleep, making them want to fall asleep, taking something away from them. And I'm going to continue down that until at the end, I want that original poster to have the last box, and I want them to have the chance to write back into that. What I like about this to start is there's no right answer. This is a conversation with your peers, your classmates, your friends, with yourself. And I think that's going to prime us as we head into this in terms of too much world. There is too much world. As we head into this world that is going to be attacked by a flu that is of epic proportions, moving faster and faster through every single major city that is crossing the oceans via airplanes, that is attacking poor and rich alike, what does too much world mean? And I like this idea of, well, where is it coming from? We're going to open with a chapter called The Theater, and we find an aging star playing King Lear. King Lear might be important, but for right now, we start at what seems like it might be the end. There's no spoiler here, but in the first page, he dies performing King Lear towards the end of the play. And we're going to try and make sense as to what happened here. Now, for our homework, I want to avoid certain literary terms, but I would ask you, as you read this first chapter and as you head into the rest of the novel, focus on the snow, particularly with one character who walks away from what essentially becomes our sort of patient zero, though it's not. It's just the end of this little micro world. And he feels the snow falling down as he gets a call that this flu is really, it's really racing forward. The snow. Think about what that snow might mean. I don't have an exact answer for you, but I think it'll be fun to chart.
On that cheerful note, that's awesome. Okay, thanks, Michael. We'll be ready to rip next time. And it's kind of a good, next week we have John Carreyrou, who wrote Bad Blood. He busted up Theranos, one of the greatest frauds ever in health, in science, in tech, in business, etc.
And there are a lot of great frauds to pick from.
There are a lot of great frauds to pick from.
And forgive me, the epigraph comes from a collection of poems, the separate notebooks from, and I'll mistake the Polish pronunciation, Sela Milosz. This is, again, just a fragment of that larger poem, but I think for our purposes, we can use the fragment as is.
Awesome. Thank you, Professor Kornheiser. That was great. Okay, let's take a quick break, and then Hannah is here. Can you join us? We would love to talk about you and your place here. So let's take a quick break, and we'll bring Hannah down here, and we'll get started again.
You're listening to Chatter on Books, coming to you almost live from Loyalty Books in beautiful downtown Silver Spring. Here's your host, Tori Clark.
This makes me so happy. We're so real. Thanks, Jamie. I am Tori Clark. This is Chatter on Books. We are very happily at Loyalty Books in Silver Spring, and we're going to talk to Hannah Oliver Depp, the owner, the guru, the godmother, the everything of this bookstore, which is fabulous. Thanks for letting us pop up here.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you. Thank you for
it's
coming.
It's great. This is a tough business you're in. I've heard that. No, yeah. It's quite so hard. We'll get to how you happen to be doing this and what you were doing before, and you were at Politics and Prose, but I've been reading and I've been watching some interviews with you. Medieval literature?
Yes. Yeah.
Explain it.
You know, black people like dragons too. It's that's a big part of it. No. Yes, I was, my mother was a professional storyteller, actually. In addition, she also had her own small business growing up. So she was quite the role model for me. And I just loved the stories. And then I'm very, very interested in the way that people deal with stress, trauma, and new things. And actually, I oddly found a lot of really great memory theory and kind of worlds colliding happening during the medieval period and how that gets expressed in literature that we would now categorize in the fantasy section, but of course was just the way people were telling stories at the
yeah.
time. I really love King Arthur, love all the different retellings. So I actually ended up studying something called medieval modernism, which is during the modernist era, this kind of like hearkening back, skipping, rejecting everything the Victorians had done and going back towards medieval literature, which is, of course, where we got all of the Tolkienic, you know, sort of adventure literature coming out of that time period. Yeah. So yeah, I love medieval literature, love the interwar period, and just sort of came together.
So medieval literature during the interwar period in Britain,
yeah.
You kind of lost me on medieval
yeah.
literature.
Yeah, yeah.
So the interwar Well, explain that in Britain, and then how's it connected to Prince Harry? Because that's all anybody cares about.
It's
right
all
now.
Anybody cares about. Yes. Okay. We can do this. We can do this.
You can make this connection.
6 degrees of book nerd separation. Well, Prince Harry served, so you know, easy one. But I do think that there is a certain sort of chaos and franticness that, of course, was happening in the interwar period, World War One interperiod, and the World War II, in the U.S. and in the Britain, just all over the world. Basically, we were just no longer able to pretend that what another country does doesn't affect what we're going to do. We were interlocked, right? But in a similar way, in the medieval period, they were kind of waking up and being like, did you guys know that China exists? Like, what? And, you know, finding out all these fully established other societies and sort of the dawn of what would become the modern era, the early modern era, that Shakespeare would then, you know, come to represent. But I do think that it's a really incredible time of mental awakening and being forced to reckon with things. And then that kind of, there's, you know, history's very cyclical, so it came back. For me, I think what I absolutely love about medieval literature and then people sort of interpreting and using tropes from medieval literature later on, whether that's in fantasy or whether that's Virginia Woolf using it in her work or Eliot, of course, it really is that it unlocks something, I think, in people's imaginations, and they're just really free to dream very big but also kind of be a little, you know, carnal and primal. And it just kind of hits people, I think, in their gut.
Is that what, do you yeah. think that's why people like Game of Thrones? And forgive me, I can see it, the book on which Game of Thrones is based.
Yeah,
but do you
yeah.
think that was part of the attraction of Game of Thrones? It allowed people to imagine wild, crazy things?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think yeah. any sort of fantasy and adventure, people can kind of tap onto that. But then the thing that keeps people coming back is being able to actually relate to something in the book. We don't, sadly, again, angry about it, do not have a dragon. But we, you know, we do all have families we'd be willing to do anything for, right? You know, it's those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Nation building is always a exciting thing to imagine yourself being caught in the middle of. It's not so much fun in real life, though.
Yeah.
So that kind of stress and people reflecting on that, that's why they used a lot of medieval literature in the interwar period, because they were so disillusioned with war.
Okay, so now here's the challenge. Make the leap from that to clowns.
Ah, that's my mother.
Small business.
Yeah, my mother was a professional storyteller. She was a clown. She frequently comes by the store and does balloon animals for kids. Because
you were part of the acts way
yes,
back when.
Absolutely, yeah. So
did you have a special clown name?
That was hers. My mother thankfully gave it to me in my initials. My full name is Hannah Abigail Margaret Oliver Depp.
Ooh.
Mouthful. So my clown name was Hammo.
Nice.
So my initials, yeah.
Did you have a special outfit?
Oh, I did. It was bright pink polka dots.
Of course.
And then we had, my brothers and I juggled.
You still do it?
Oh, I'm so terrified.
Okay,
I never
somebody get her some
than.
Oranges.
My brothers can literally juggle fire, torches. They can stilt walk. yo-yo, you know, unicycle. They were like very into skill building for all of that. For me, I was more like, I want to tell stories and face paint. And but very quickly, actually, as a very young person, became more interested in like the crowd control at the event and making sure that the accounts payable had been settled.
Good for you.
And just, it turns out that like maybe my ability in the area was going to be something else.
So I can actually juggle one item.
Yeah.
And then I can add a second. But when I get to three, it
doesn't
work.
Yeah. That's the.
Yeah. I basically got the juggling scars, which is how you're supposed to train. And then I was like, I feel good about that. I'm good. Yeah.
But those experiences helped you in your current business.
Correct.
So you did work at Politics of Pros at one point, right?
For years. Yeah. Yeah.
Independent, but pretty big, pretty established.
Exactly. So I'd worked at several used bookstores while going through grad school and undergrad. And then I had. Was in the middle of working on PhD work and deciding the direction and basically committing lifelong to academia. And I started working at Politics and Prose and was amazed at the impact it has on its community and on the publishing industry. And I'd always loved bookstores. I'd grown up literally going to Politics and Prose. I'm kind of the generation, while I worked there, of the returning generation. We've mm-hmm. grown up there and then either working there or publishing novels or, you know, it's just the impact that store had was really incredible. But as you say, it's a juggernaut. It's a huge deal. That store has really come to represent a lot of things to a lot of people, and they are massive. But there weren't a lot of people who were still working there who had been there at the beginning, right? There's a couple people. They've had a couple directors who've been there for a really long time and buyers, but not a lot of people could tell me how you build a bookstore, right? And so I started going to a lot of conferences for our industry. And then I also actually worked for 3 years at a store called Word, uh-huh. which has two locations, one in Jersey City and one in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. And they were a much newer store. And so I was the right hand of the owner. And so I was just like, tell me how we make this happen.
So for anyone who loves books,
yeah.
I know I have this fantasy, and a lot of people have this fantasy, that, you know, at my advanced stage, at some point I'll retire and I'll open a bookstore, because mm-hmm. you know, what better environment is there than a bookstore? Mm. And in my fantasy,
she's laughing at you as you're saying.
I know.
That.
In my fantasy, nice. I don't actually sell any books. Mm-hmm. When anybody picks mm-hmm. up a book, I discourage them from buying it, and mm-hmm. People just come in, and that's it. But so that's this fantasy of this wonderful bookstore. Tell us what it's really like.
So there is an element, first of all, I tell a lot of people to buy books. So I really recommend you sell the books to people, just like a basic business practice. But I would say it is a good chunk of my day is balancing the fantasy of that, both in my mind and my customer's mind, and the actual job. A good chunk of this is just small business work. It's small business retail, right? There's box carrying, there's managing purchase orders, there's QuickBooks, there's payroll, right? There's arguing for better taxes with your city governments. There's a big chunk of what we do. And the other half is the fantasy of getting to talk to people about books all day, right? But I think anyone who is in the business of books, whether that's publishing, a librarian, a teacher, a writer, a bookseller, will tell you that books are incredibly frustrating because everyone in the industry cares so much. Hmm. So, you know, like nobody's in this industry because at no point in any point in this industry is anyone making a lot of money. So everybody here cares a lot. But everyone's also very protective of their little book babies.
Yeah.
So it can be a frustrating industry to work in because of that. But it also is extremely rewarding because at least you know you go to work with people who really care
yeah.
every day.
But local independent bookstores are doing better. Mm-hmm. And they are starting to thrive. So not just survive, they are starting to thrive.
Right.
I have my own theories on why that is, but why do you think that is? I mean, this place is great. You started out with Upshur Street Books, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then this was a pop-up. Silver Spring was a pop-up over a year ago.
Yep.
And then you started here full-time a couple months ago?
Yeah. We came back as a pop-up during the holidays while we were finalizing
right.
negotiations on this space.
So why do you think it is here? People are drawn to this? I mean, we have all these thousands of wonderful people who crammed in here tonight on a Monday night.
It's literally,
to be
I mean,
here.
we really need to get the fire
street
marshal.
Had to be
care.
Shut.
Yeah.
Okay.
The street had
sure.
to be shut down out front. Why do you think that is?
I do think it has a lot to do with books. It also has a lot to do with what's going on in our culture right now. The books were never in trouble. There was sort of this like book panic every few years that the books are going to disappear and they're always fine and they never go anywhere. Humanity is very committed to storytelling and to books, physical, digital, audio. We like any way
you yourself, you listen to books and you give up on books, right?
Oh, I do. We'll God bless you. That. Yeah. I'm very passionate about it. But people like to build community around books. That's not hard. And it's there's very few public places to go anymore, actually, that are not restaurants or bars.
Right.
We do a lot of fun, like books and booze cross programming, but it's really nice to go somewhere and just chat with people and meet people who like books. And a bookstore is a nexus for a lot of different people for those reasons. And we're running out of public spaces in America. We really, really are. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that as we become more Netflix and chill, as we become just more like everything's coming to us in our houses, you want to have somewhere to go. And downtowns are built around bookstores.
People want human connection.
People want the connection. And when you do leave your house, you don't want to only find chain stores that you can just order online from, or restaurants and nail salons, although, you know, all of those things are fun and have a purpose, but you need something more. You're looking for something more, and a bookstore is just a signal for that to people.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you take your little one. The hammer doesn't really go to bookstores, but...
He's reading.
Okay. You read to him, but you take Walker to bookstores, right?
We do, yeah.
Yeah. Does he like it?
He loves the bookstore, and, you know, to that point, the same community that happens in a public library, whether you're in Montgomery County, D.C., Virginia. But no, the first thing I do when I walk into a bookstore like this is I immediately go to the kids selection. And actually, as you're trying to build out this new location, I'm trying to wonder about the balance, because you have a limited amount of space and you're trying to make sure you have books that actually sell.
Yep.
So you can meet your quotas. And I'm thinking, I'm seeing books that are there for the baby shower, but you also want a book that, say, a young reader in elementary school, where there's not as much space devoted to that because the practicality. And I wonder about the changing demos of this downtown Silver Spring area, where you're having a lot of babies, mm-hmm. toddlers, a lot of those gifts. And then you're sort of skipping to the kids who grew up here and you're going straight to the YA, which mm-hmm. is sort of front center in the window and has a nice little nook for some of the kids to maybe even find a corner and try
to
read some of that.
The YA kids got to have a nook. They have to have their space away from everyone else. And I respect that. Cool. They need it. It's important.
It's funny because you look at the books and I'm looking at the bookshelves, because we have so many books in our house that are stacked on the floor and on table. It's like, can we get some shelves to put these? I'm like, I'm always amazed. It's like, oh, those, I like those shelves. Those shelves are good. We should get some of those in our house.
It's 9 foot and 6 foot shelves someday. Yeah, the kids' books, we actually, you know, we have three books cases for sort of, you know, what in the industry is called middle grade. It's various levels of chapter books. And it's really interesting, but the kids go through such a huge change reading-wise in that time period, right? They kind of can exist in picture book land for a while. And then once you start reading chapters, you're going from these little slim chapter books, these fatter ones. Graphic novels, of course, are a huge help for readers. And then you get to, like, chapter, and then they're in chapter for, like, a minute, and then they skip on to reading, you know, grown-up books or whatever. So it's a really hard balance. One of my favorite things to read personally, and also I have the fondest, I think, nostalgic memories about, you know, the chapter books I read when I was 11. So, we do think about that a lot. And the readership here, it's like, they're, you know, it's we both of our we have a location in Petworth and a location here, and they're stroller city a lot of the times, right? We got a lot of young families. But there's also, that's genuinely not the only people who are rolling mm-hmm. through here. So,
what has surprised you the most? Again, you were born to do this. Given your,
I love
you,
it.
You're born to do this. Who was it that said he was born to run for president, who's no longer running for president? Who was that? Whatchamacallit? Come on.
I'll never.
Thank you, Beto.
I'll
couldn't
never
remember
forget
his name.
Old
the, I knew it was a funny
never
name.
Never forget old Whatchamacallit.
Yeah, forget old Whatchamacallit.
What's his name, yeah.
We're not burnout at all.
But it was. Where is Beto and what is he doing?
He's hopefully napping. He looks like he's needed a nap like the last 3 months
really
ago.
Did.
I was like, sir,
he
you were
really
working
did.
Very hard.
But you were born to do this, and it was in your blood and in your upbringing and everything. What has surprised you the most?
I haven't been too surprised yet.
That's probably a good sign.
I've mostly been pleasantly surprised.
Good.
You hope that people will care, mm-hmm. and they have, and that's incredible.
Right.
And you can't really take that for granted. I'm always surprised, I think. You really can't put people in a corner. I think that hasn't surprised me, because now I've been doing this for a few years, but I do... You know, we'll look at our restock and we'll be like, you know, I thought I had everybody pegged, and then you cannot truly predict what that book is going to be that suddenly everyone in your neighborhood is going to be reading. We spend our lives trying to, you know, force everyone into trends so we can handle our restock and handle our orders properly. Sure. And then
makes,
you know,
bookkeeping so much easier.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then something happens and everybody, you got it. And then everybody, you know, suddenly, you know, they can't stop doing it. I do love the resurgence of things like when something like Little Women works. When the movie is interesting
and slightly different.
I liked the movie a lot.
Did you?
And then it makes people go back and read the book because it's so, you know,
wait for the
plays
for
the heads. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, oh, Lord.
So my wife wanted to buy a book.
The already happening, actually.
My wife wanted to buy a book the other day. She saw it at some place. It was like $12. She came home and she, you know, Googled it on some unnamed online bookseller. And it was like $6.
Yeah.
So make the case, why should we come here and buy it for $12 if it costs $6 online?
That's a really good question. So I think some of it has to do with how much you care about what happens with money. So there's a few things. First of all, your taxes and your money stay in your community when you spend it in your community. So you're not only doing things like creating jobs and providing better things like schools and roads and your awesome library, but you're also actually, like, the money circulating in here genuinely stays in here. And then you have another things like environmental impact that you can think about. Next day, I was laughing very hard that the person who owns that unnamed website giving so much money for the environment but causing simultaneously more damage than he could ever repair with next day shipping.
Yeah, when you think about what goes into getting that book to your house.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's not actually free delivery, by the way.
Not by any means. I am not a perfect employer, and I'm learning every day, but I'm not abusive to my employees, and I think I am not really at a stretch here to say that what happens in those warehouses is, you know, considered by the several countries in the EU to be literally against human rights practices. So there, you know, nothing is cheap without a reason. I also don't like to shame people. Books are expensive. And it can, access is really important to me. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate that, but I think particularly with that website, as opposed to maybe just getting a used book, which is also a great option. And we have some great used bookstores around, and there's some great websites that are not that website that sell used books. You can get things at a reasonable price that will fit your needs. A lot more money stays in your community when you buy with an indie bookstore. The more of the money goes to the actual people responsible for making the book. So you're actually supporting the author that you love or hoping to see more work from. So those sales are genuine and the connection's real, and you're far more likely to get authors and cool things like podcast recordings and whatnot in your community. That money leaves, and then you never see it again.
Of people pouring into Silver Spring. Yeah.
So, hundreds of thousands.
So what would you say to someone like me who already owns more books mm-hmm. than I could possibly read? I mean, if I figure out how many books I could read in a year.
Are we supposed to read all the books we buy?
No, some of them I just feel good to have. I just have them.
Totems.
But I do the math, how many books I read in a year, how many years I have left in my life. There's no way I could read even a tenth of the books I have in my house. Why should I buy more?
Well, first of all, one of my greatest pleasures in life is a book culling, because I set aside some that I'm going to be giving away, some that I know are going to be gifts to people, and some that are going to be donated, et cetera.
Marie Kondo approach to books. You have to have
It's really funny when everyone was mad about that, because I was like, guys, we do this all the time. If you don't want to read it, you get rid of it and get a different book.
And there's nothing better than recommending a book to someone who then becomes a huge fan of it.
Yeah, it's a drug. I built a whole bookstore because of it. It's just like, aha, got another one. But I also, I do think it is an inexplicable thing to just be like, the books make a home. It's like one of the kind of tenets of loyalty bookstores. And I think most people who are listening to this podcast, books help make a home. So it's not so much to me about whether or not you get to read every single thing on your shelf. If it matters to you, keep it there. And if it doesn't, switch it out and get different things. There used to be in my, especially when I was in academia, that there was a race to read literally everything, and to be a person. At some point, I was going to get a gold star because I'd read all the things I was supposed to read, and they would put a gold star on my tombstone: has read all the books. And actually, becoming part of the book industry this way has made me realize, like, there is a ton coming out. I'm never going to read it all. There's a ton undiscovered.
But this is very exciting because it is actually proof that the books aren't dead. Yeah. I have a lot of thoughts about what is and is not being published and like how much money is going to what things. But it's so exciting to me that there's new amazing authors I had no clue were coming out when I was in academia. And they're doing incredibly interesting things. And I can read purely for pleasure, and I can read to really stretch my brain inside out. You know, there's all sorts of different ways that I can read, and I can be reading multiple things at the same time. People were like, how much are you reading? And I was like, well, 37 books, maybe, or maybe none. I'm not really sure.
Okay, but pick one. Yeah. We'll get you out on this. Pick one. In the next 4-6 weeks, what's a book you wish people would pick up that they've not heard about?
Ooh, they haven't heard about it yet. We have some really good stuff coming out. I believe in the next couple of weeks, the new Samantha Irby is coming out. And either you know and are obsessed with Samantha Irby, the essayist, or you've never heard of her. So I'm going to go ahead and mention that. It's called Wow, No Thank You. And it's extremely therapeutic to read. She's very, very funny essayist. This is her third book of essays, I think. She is kind of internet fame, but is a wonderful commentator. She is just – it's really like a stress relief to read her essays because they're funny, but they're not tuned out. Mm-hmm. She refuses to take – the hits that the world wants to give her as a large black woman who has a chronic illness. And she's out there punching back, and it's really, really wonderful. So if you haven't heard of Samantha Irby, pick up everything she's written, and then be careful reading it in public because people will be like, are you okay, as you like cry laugh sitting on a bench or on the train.
Personal experience.
Yes, very yeah. much so personal experience. I have gotten a lot of concerned looks on the metro reading Samantha Irby.
All right, Hannah Oliver Depp, thank you so much again for letting us pop up here. It's just
anytime.
Fabulous. And everyone should come to Loyalty. Jamie, where's Loyalty? Quick. 823.
Loyalty Bookstores, located conveniently at 823 Ellsworth Avenue in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Great parking.
Free parking after 6 p.m. Reasonable parking before 6 p.m.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
We're back. You're listening to Chatter on Books from Loyalty Books in Silver Spring, Maryland. Here's Tori Clark.
Thanks, Jamie. That is great. We are here. Loyalty Books is fabulous. Everyone should come by. And we're now going to talk to Andrea Chambly, who I got to meet through our dear friend David Aldridge, who would love to be here, but he is at spring training. Couldn't get back in time. Andrea, welcome. Thanks for being here. And it's a remarkable story. It's a remarkable work, the book, Capital Basketball. But let's talk about June 2018. You and your husband, John McNamara, were married for 33 years?
Yes.
Met at University of Maryland?
33 years. We met at the University of Maryland when I was dating another journalism major named John.
No, and, that's convenient.
And he was a wonderful guy, but a little commitment phobic. So we broke up and I started dating John.
And he was a sports fiend. You were a sports fiend.
I covered sports for my high school county paper, and John covered it for his high school paper and for the Diamondback at Maryland, and ever since then.
Which the Diamondback at Maryland is a big deal. I guess they recently went online only, right, which was kind of a big change. But the Diamondback is a big deal in terms of covering not just Maryland sports but local sports, right?
Right. It's a big deal. I mean, Maryland basketball was terrific when we were there. I'll still remember Buck Williams and how magnetic Cole Fieldhouse was when he was playing. And we both loved basketball, especially.
Mm-hmm. You went on to become a lawyer.
I did.
Had a little sad look on your face when I said that. We have an interesting relationship with lawyers on this show.
I volunteer that information because lawyers get a tough rap. But when I was in elementary school, my dad was working for the Federal Trade Commission, and he told me the story about how Listerine was telling consumers that it cured the common cold, and I was indignant and infuriated, and I decided that I would be a consumer protection lawyer, and I made it. I work for the Food and Drug Administration as a consumer protection lawyer.
Mm-hmm. And John went on to cover sports in the DMV, as we call it, for many, many, many years. He was just the rock star of encyclopedic knowledge, right? About primarily basketball, other things as well, but primarily basketball, right?
He knew basketball inside and out. He never got a trivia question wrong on baseball either. But when we were looking for a peer reviewer for this book, since it's an academic publisher, they wanted a peer reviewer. We could not find one.
Because he was the guy people would go to.
He was the guy who knew this stuff.
Right. So it's 2018. It's the spring of 2018. And you two are contemplating retirement. You're both working hard, but you're thinking, okay, we're going to do some of these things. And he had been working on this book for a while about D.C. basketball. June 2018. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was a beautiful sunny day. I mean, imagine the perfect temperature, the perfect sky. I had worked out at lunch, and I took my computer and my salad and went out to the cafeteria patio at work and started catching up on those emails that always come in when you're away from your desk. And friends and family started texting me and emailing me, asking me what was going on in Annapolis. Do I know where John is? Is everything okay? And I didn't think much of it, and I Googled Annapolis, and I saw the helicopter videos and the police tape and the people coming out of the building with their hands over their head. And I just snapped my computer shut and ran for the car. It took about 8 hours for the police to reach out to me. I had gotten 13 reporters asking me since then, but the police came to my front door after 10 p.m. And by then I knew it doesn't take 8 hours to get good news. So after that, I was kind of moving through mud for a couple of weeks, feeling like I was walking through water. And I guess I identified his body, and I guess I planned his memorial, and I guess I picked out an urn, and I had to put the urn somewhere, and I hadn't been able to go into his den, but I went into his den to put the urn there, and I saw these boxes of folders that were organized by year and by school and by player. And then I logged into his computer, and I found the chapters that were almost finished, and I just knew that I had to finish this. I had to finish it. The stories. It's not just a sports book. It's a human. It's human stories in this book.
He had started in 2007. Did I get that year right? He had started years and years ago.
Yes. The coach from Archbishop Carroll passed away, and he had a 55-game winning streak and, I don't know, 15 or 20 championships. He knew all those numbers off the top of his head, but he was disappointed. He said, I've been writing this book in my head since the first game that I saw in 1973. Mm. And now Bob Dwyer has died and I can't do it. And I said, yes, you will.
In the preface, John gave you credit or inspiration or instigation for writing the book. You said something funny about old timers and they're all going away.
I don't remember calling them
old timers. I bet his memory was better than yours, but go ahead.
I suppose I might have. He usually didn't get that wrong, but I don't think I called them old timers. But yes, I told him Morgan Wooten is still here and Joe Gallagher is still here, and you will get on the telephone and call them and tell them you're going to finish this book. And he started in 2007, and 13 years later, it was on the brink of being finished.
And so the book, we're talking about The Capital of Basketball, A History of D.C. Area High School Hoops, started by John McNamara, finished by his wife, Andre Chamblee. It is about D.C. basketball, and we were talking before the show, and I fail at the words, encyclopedic, just the depth and breadth of information he had about individual players, individual games, individual minutes in a game that to some people wouldn't be important. But if you've grown up in the DMV, and I've been here for almost 40 years, so I feel like I've grown up. Claude, born and raised here. Michael, born and raised here. Jamie, how long?
Since I was 2 years old. I grew up in Alexandria. Went to T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria.
D.C. Hoops is a big deal. But it's about all of that, but it's also about segregation, about desegregation. It's about character. It's just remarkable. But what was the greatest challenge for you in finishing this book? Because it was in boxes, right? He had a lot of things on his computer, but a lot of it was in boxes. There were photographs without captions. Tell us about the process of pulling it together.
He had written almost all the text, and he had already started shopping it around trying to find a publisher. And all the publishers wanted to use this as like a loss leader and then have a book on Chicago and New York and Brooklyn. And John said it took me 13 years to write this one.
Yeah.
So he wanted to sell this book as it was. One of those folders was called Photographs I Want to Use. There was 176 pictures in there. And there were pictures of guys jumping up to get a rebound and coaches in a circle around their players. And the teams didn't have their names on the jerseys back then. They didn't have the school name on the jersey. You can't look up a player by his high school number. So there's a picture of James Brown from CBS in here, and he's about 14 years old. And now
James
that
James Brown, by the way, commercial break, and this is just so irreverent. James Brown shows up in everything. Has anybody noticed that? Every book, every Netflix documentary, every 30 for 30. There's James Brown. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
James Brown, he's terrific.
You can't identify these pictures. But your husband knew who everybody was, right?
He knew who everybody was. He knew what game it was. He knew how many points that player scored in that game. He knew what the final score was. He knew if that game was a championship game or on the way to it. He knew everything about those pictures. So thank goodness for David Elfin. He's a local sports writer. Mm-hmm. He helped me with lots of things with this book, but he also said kind of flippantly, like, oh, Morgan Wooten will tell you who they are. And I said, Morgan Wooten's famous. I can't ask Morgan Wooten. And a couple days later, I was on Morgan Wooten's sofa, and he knew every kid in those pictures. He didn't know what game it was necessarily or how many points they scored, but they could have been his kid or somebody else's kid on a different team, and he knew who they all were. And once I knew who they were, I had to go back and find their yearbook, find information about that game, get the final score and the points from their yearbook.
So Morgan Wooten is legendary. Is he like the biggest star of the book?
There are many stars.
There are many stars. Yeah. He is a perfect example of what makes this town special, though, and that is the coaching culture here. I was just talking to somebody whose kid went out of town, and he doesn't like the fact that his coach throws things and yells at the players. And Morgan Wooten said, if you have to do that, you're not coaching. You're just scaring people. But he was hired by Joe Gallagher from St. John's, who mentored Morgan Wooten, and they were lifelong friends. And there's just a whole culture of players in this area that went on to become coaches, and good coaches who care about their kids. There was Bob Dwyer, we already talked about, and John Thompson from Archbishop Carroll, the same school. There was David Carrusco, the first Latino American who was coaching white kids, and Gene Doan from Blair. There was William Roundtree from Spingarn, and David Vetter from Flint Hill, and Mike McLeese from Dunbar, and Thomas Hargrove from Anacostia. All these people played ball and were determined to give back and help create the next generation of young men, whether they played in the NBA or not.
So here's what struck me about the book, and as someone who has thought about writing a book but never gotten around to it, I've written some book proposals, but that's about as far as I ever got. When you write a book, you have a certain amount of immortality. And this book, you know, we live in an information age where we think we can just Google anything. You know, if we want to know who – and there's so much in this book that if you had not written this book, would just be lost history.
Right. There's no YouTube video.
There's no
Adrian
way.
Dantley.
It's amazing in that regard, I think.
A lot of the papers and the files were microfiche.
You might need to explain for our listeners. I don't think under people know what 60.
Microfiche is like an X-ray kind of picture of it's like a negative of a page of a newspaper, and you have to take the negative and hold it up to light to see what the newspaper was. So he had lots of those. So every night after he started this book, every night he was either on the phone with an interview, at the library, writing down notes from the last interview, arranging to take somebody out for coffee or breakfast or lunch to interview them. It was every night, and I was like, Donna
Reed. Did it drive you crazy?
No. I had started teaching a night class then, so we kind of just sat side by side on our computers and ate whatever you could eat without a plate.
A lot of things.
Here's an interesting side note about microfilm and microfiche. I did an interview with the head of the National Archives, and I asked them about their challenge of preserving things. And, of course, so much stuff now is preserved in digital format on hard drives or other things that don't last. You know, videotape doesn't last more than 20 years. All the things that we save things don't last. But so I said, so what's the most permanent way to save something? Is it paper? Because they have paper at the National Archives that are hundreds of years old. He said, no, it's microfilm.
No.
Because microfilm will, if properly preserved, will last forever. Well, not forever, but for very much longer than these other things. And you don't need any special equipment to read it. You don't need to have a special operating system or decode the thing. You can actually, as you said, hold it up to the light and see what it says.
And actually read it.
Huh. But we're beyond that now. Nothing is saved that way anymore.
Yeah.
Which is why putting it in a book is really important.
You can't Google it. One thing you can't Google, one of my favorite stories is on the back of the book, there's this picture of these formidable athletes, an African-American team, and the guy in the middle is Dr. E.B. Henderson, who heard about this new game up in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he made the trip up there to talk to Dr. Naismith about this game. And they actually did use peach baskets, and they didn't think to cut out the bottoms. So it was nine.
Really slows down the game.
It was nine players, and you couldn't dribble. You could only pass. So I'm thinking the best exercise you got in the whole game was running up and down the ladder to get the ball out of the basket. And he brought it back here and introduced it to the African-American community, where churches were helping make sure the young people got an education and had a well-rounded experience with sports and civic engagement. And then there was a circus performer, a white guy who wanted to be fit over the winter. He was a personal trainer of sorts for the president. Between the two of them, they turned it into a five-man game with dribbling and cut out the bottoms of the peach basket. And E.B. Henderson strove to make sure the kids, the white and black kids, were playing together, because all you needed is five people and a hoop. And he was upset that they were segregated once they got into high school, and certainly in the pros. So he started the NAACP. He wrote thousands of essays about segregation. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book called The Negro in Sports, which is still something you can find today. And he made Mike Uline of D.C. desegregate his sports stadium. So his accomplishments on and off the court were just so remarkable. And he never gave up.
One of the most remarkable things in this book, when you know about John McNamara, who I knew because of David Aldridge and people like that, you think, okay, it's just going to be gritty stats, you know, who coached which game, which player had the most points. But it is about a lot of very interesting things going on in this area, in the District of Columbia, the DMV.
It's not an almanac. It's a narrative.
Yeah, very much a narrative. Did anything surprise you along the way when you were putting this together?
Well, I was surprised I hadn't heard of E.B. Henderson. Mm-hmm. I mean, he obviously accomplished a lot. And just the evolution of the game, they still call them cagers because the men used to play surrounded by a chain link fence. And this E.B. Henderson team figured out that if you throw the offensive player with the ball against the fence, the ball will jar loose. So the D.C. area was responsible for getting referees. A guy named Dallas Shirley started coaching referees. And so we produced the nation's first refs for the game and the standards that they need. I was surprised at the fact that D.C. is really the birthplace of basketball, not New York and not Chicago and all these cities that claim that they're big basketball cities are, but for most of D.C.'s history, we haven't had a good professional team here. I mean, it's great to have the Nationals and the Capitals now, and the Redskins have had days in the sun, too. But in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, our sports life was void of any good team.
Yeah. I worked at WTOP Radio when the Bullets beat the Supersonics. That was the last time.
Brief shining moment. Brief shining moment.
I fell in love with the Bullets in the late 60s, mid to late 60s, too.
Somebody told me once, I don't know if this is true, but if you go down to the store at Cap One Arena now, and they have all the usual stuff for the Caps, and they have the Wizards, and then there's a section where they still sell Bullets shirts and jerseys and things like that, that they sell more of those than they do.
I do think they have
the
best logo in the business with the two hands.
Yeah, exactly.
But for most of DC's history, we didn't have great teams. So people would pay the $2 or the nickel to see high school.
So was this a labor of love, or maybe more appropriately a labor of grief, to make sure that John lives on? Because he has now, you achieve some level of immortality just through this book that will last beyond him.
Well, certainly for him, it was a labor of love. I know the last few years we've had so many layoffs in journalism and mm-hmm. print media, and so many of John's friends lost their jobs. And when you're 55 years old and laid off, you don't have people scrambling to hire you again. Especially in sports, there's people who'll do it for free because they love it and they're young and they're living with their parents. And John said, I need to hold off for the layoffs because no one's going to buy a sports book from someone who's not a sports writer. And I just remembered that in my head. And I said, John, they're gonna remember you as a sports writer.
Yeah.
And if nothing else came of this, if we didn't sell a single copy, then I know he was remembered as a sports writer. And whenever I talk about gun violence, I talk about John. And whenever I talk about John, I talk about gun violence. Because he should be remembered as a sports writer, and he should be remembered for how he lived and not just how he died.
He'll be remembered because of this book, and it is a remarkable tribute accomplishment on your part to make this book happen, because a lot of people would have said, I'm not going to do that, right? I got more things to worry about. I'm not going to do that. So it's an incredible accomplishment that you were able to finish this book, The Capital of Basketball, but it does... it's the segue. It does go to where you're spending a lot of your time now, which is you are one of the most effective, one of the most active spokespeople out there on gun safety and gun violence. Is that anything you imagined ever, that you'd be an advocate on any topic, much less this one? And how do you get up every day and have to talk about what happened to your husband as part of your advocacy?
Well, I was aware of Moms Demand action before this happened, and I had put them on my list of token donations because mm-hmm. I'm just a federal employee. I don't have wealth that I can pass along to any cause in particular. But when I was rattling around trying to figure out how to keep my head above water, the people of Moms Demand Action contacted me and they said, what do you need? How can we help you? And they were I don't think I had anything to ask for them right away because I didn't know what I need. But then when I thought about it, I said, I need to do something. That's what I need. And they said, no, you wait a year. People are still in shock and you'll be tired. And I thought, in 365 days, there's going to be 365 more mass shootings. And 200 people every day who get shot and live through it, and another 100 people a day who get shot and don't live through it. And I said, in a year, that no one's going to remember who John was because there's going to be too many people who get killed in the meantime. So I said, I need to do something now. I mean, I don't know how much longer I can do it. It's draining, and the gun violence, the gun extremists have posted my address on their Facebook page, and they show up at my house and they mail things. They mail pictures of men with guns for me in my mailbox when I get home from work. But one day they followed me to my car, and I just turned around and I said, what do you think you can do to me? Because if you want to kill my family, you missed your chance. So I just knew I had to do something so nobody else has to do something next mm-hmm. year, if that's possible.
What do you wish people knew? What you, and we, you know, people in the DMV, we get up every day, we think we know what's going on in the world, we read, we watch, we listen. What do you wish we knew? What do you wish we were doing?
Well, I think I talked a little bit about how it feels like the ground underneath you is gone and you're falling into some water and you're drowning. And what I've found is that water's full of people who are drowning. All of us, I've met so many gun violence survivors. We're just gasping for air and trying to keep our head above water, and we're all there right in front of you, drowning in the water right in front of you while you're on the riverbank. And we don't want you to join us in this tumultuous, awful pit. We don't want to take away your guns either. I mean, there's plenty of things we can do. We want to help you store it safely. We want to help you keep it away from your kids. We want to help you keep it away from people in your family who might be thinking about suicide. We're not being extremists. For some causes, it's convenient to describe us that way.
So I saw a meme on Facebook the other day, and of course, you know, you should never actually pay much attention to these, but they are an indicator of how a lot of people think. And the meme said something about along the lines of, and I'm not going to quote this exactly, but when conservatives don't like guns, they don't buy or get a gun. But when liberals don't like guns, they want to take everyone's guns away. And I remember thinking to myself, I know a lot of liberals. Some liberals are good friends of mine. I don't know a single person who wants to take away everybody's gun. But they want to talk about, what kind of common, background checks does everybody, should people be able to get, AR-15 assault weapons? Do we need magazines that have multiple weapons? All kinds of common sense things that you could talk about. We are so divided in the country that everything gets reduced to, I hate guns or I love guns. And it's just, it's discouraging. So when you're advocating for common sense reform in gun laws, do you feel like you're just mission impossible?
Well, I don't think that's an option. If you feel like it's mission impossible, and then I just throw up my hands. I feel like there's a lot of disinformation, like that meme you said, that we're going to take guns away. I mean, that's just disinformation. And that's, frankly, because that's all they've got. I mean, they're not saying, they want background checks. Isn't that horrible? They don't say that.
So one of the things that people say all the time, every time there's a tragedy, they say, well, whatever gun reform you're advocating would not have changed the outcome, wouldn't have saved your husband at the Capital Gazette. What do you say to that?
I say we've abdicated the chance to save my husband. We've already lost that chance. I'm trying to save the next child, the next kid, the next group of school children. No matter how the violator got the gun, we can stop it. It's not inevitable. Gun violence is not inevitable. And it's convenient to think it's inevitable because then there's no work left to be done. But it's not inevitable.
So let's get you out on this. What do you want people to remember about John?
Well, other than his determination to be remembered as a sports writer, the thing I remember about him is all the nice things he did for me. I mean, every day he made my coffee, and he hated coffee.
That's a big one. He scraped the smell.
I know.
Might not
I go
like
downstairs
smell.
Now, and I'm yeah. like, darn. He scraped the ice off my windshield. He would go to the grocery store and come back. The heaviest thing in the grocery store, believe me, is the 12-pack of Snapple Diet Raspberry
totally.
Iced Tea.
You haven't bought cat litter lately.
He would bring it home. And I know lots of people love the Instagram-ready promposal things, that the big gestures people do, the proposal on the big screen at an event or something. John just did a million things, and not just for me, for everybody, every day. His coworkers told me he never left when he was finished. He always went around to the paper and say, can I help you with deadline? What do you need? And then he would go. So he enjoyed doing nice things for people.
Nice. That's a great tribute. The book is The Capital of Basketball, A History of D.C. Area High School Sports, started by John McNamara, largely finished, Andrea Chambly would say, but I would say really not finished until you took it on. So thank you for doing it. It is fabulous. We do like to sell books. Hannah's looking over. We like to sell books. This is a fabulous book. If you have a sports fan, if you have a budding sports journalist, if you're looking for Father's Day gifts coming up, March Madness is coming up, all sorts of reasons to get this book. If you care about the DMV, it's great DMV lore. I was reading some of it, looking up, okay, I know that intersection, that kind of thing, thinking about coal, et cetera. It's a fabulous book. Andrea, thank you for doing this. Thank you for being with us.
I've been keeping his blog alive at thecapitalofbasketball.com, and you can order books there and find out where the next event is.
What is your next event?
Wednesday, we're at the Wheaton Regional Library. Actually, in an hour from now, I'll be at the Catholic High School Basketball Championship.
Are you rooting for somebody?
And we're going to be at the book festivals in Gaithersburg,
yes,
and Annapolis and on Solomon's Island. So we still have a lot of work to do.
Excellent. Well, good luck with all of it. It really is really remarkable. Guys, I'm going to make an executive decision and say talking about Steve Jobs right now would seem really stupid. So we're just going to I think we'll skip that. We're never over time when it's really good. And this has been really good. Let me just finish up with a couple of things. Thank you, Jean, Hannah. Thank you for letting us be here at Loyalty. Thank you for the thousands of people who poured out of the streets of Silver Spring to be with us tonight. Calvert Woodley, thank you very much. Everyone should go. Use Nationals 5. You supposedly still get $5 off if you go there. Jamie, Claude, Michael, thank you for being here. Michael, I'm afraid the kids have probably been put to bed by now, but you can wake them up when you get home.
I just checked my 401k, by the way. And it's now a 201K.
Exactly. Like,
it's a little disturbing.
Jamie will now be moving to the used bookstores. And next week, I am really, really excited about this. We have John Carreyrou, Wall Street Journal reporter, who busted Elizabeth Holmes and the whole Theranos scam, one of the biggest scams ever in the world of tech, science, health, you name it. His book is called Bad Blood, and I have been stalking this man for over a year, and we finally got him. So next week we will have John Carreyrou, and we hope you'll join us. And Jamie, will you take us out, or whatever it's called?
Chatter on Books is a wholly owned production of Tory Klein. Any broadcast or rebroadcast of these comments without the express written consent of Tory Klein is strictly prohibited. Opinions expressed on Chatter on Books may be changed in the future, so don't hang your hat on them. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, guys.